Triple E, I would like to welcome you to session number 32 on the subject of electromechanical versus solid state. First, I would like to take a moment for an announcement. Is there a Mr. Simmons in the audience? Mr. Simmons? You know, as the president of a small company, I'm continually plagued by the problem of, am I doing the right thing? You know, at this moment, my family's relaxing on a sunny beach in Puerto Rico. And but seriously, though, this is a subject that's very close to my heart. Our company designs and manufactures control systems for automatic machinery. And when I stop to think of the many thousands of dollars we've spent to get the answers to relatively simple problems, well, I would have been here anyway, even if I weren't the chairman. Many years ago, one of my customers asked me to develop a solid-state control system for a machine, and I declined. I told him that the state of the art hasn't yet gotten to the point where I felt it was feasible. And of course, without my telling him, I meant by the state of the art is that I didn't have the background. But today, the picture's a little different, fortunately. But solid-state systems are coming into use more and more in industrial equipment. The reason it hasn't happened overnight, obviously, is like with any new technology, there are problems. And in order to use the information in the field intelligently, we have to be aware of the problems. Otherwise, as we've done, you end up spending many thousands of dollars to find the answers to simple problems. Excuse me. We're fortunate today in having some speakers who have a wealth of experience in both areas, and it's electromechanical and solid state. I'd like to point out, though, that the title of this lecture sounds like a real knockdown, drag-out battle between the proponents of relays and the proponents of solid-state devices. However, as engineers, we realize that, or we should realize, that this isn't the case. Our object as engineers is to do the best job we possibly can for our employers or our customers or clients. In order to accomplish this, we must know our way around both areas and in each case give the customer what best suits his needs. As I said, we're fortunate in having speakers with a wealth of experience in both these areas. Unfortunately, one of our speakers, Mr. Pacenti, who was scheduled to be the third speaker, was not able to make it due to a death in the family. I feel we will be able to cover the subject adequately without any problems, because in addition to the two main speakers, we also have additional gentlemen who are well qualified to answer any questions that you might have. We will start with the presentation of the two papers, and at the conclusion of the papers, we will have a question and answer period. Our first speaker will speak on the title of his paper will be There Will Always Be a Relay. Our speaker is Mr. Hugh J. Cohen, Director of Engineering for Struthers Dunn Incorporated. Mr. Cohen brings to the platform 30 years of experience with relays. He received his BS and EE from Drexel University in 1947 and his MS and EE in 1961, also from Drexel. In addition to his duties with Struthers Dunn, Mr. Cohen is an adjunct professor at Drexel University Evening College. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Mr. Cohen.
Thank you, sir. The topic of which to use, solid state or electromagnetic relays, being discussed today, I may say that my part of this is to have something good to say about electromagnetic relays, but we can't deny that solid state is taking over in a lot of places. It has great speed, makes a compact design, it's good for long life, bounce free, many advantages that relays are trying to keep up with. However, the place where it's being used most is in systems, where the entire system, right from the outset, is designed with solid state in mind, with solid state inputs, solid state outputs, and we find that even here there's some need to include some relays to perform some of the output functions that are better performed by relays. Even though solid state is taking over a lot of the functions that were once performed by relays alone, such as relay logic systems, now many times being replaced by solid state. In spite of this, we find that the relay usage is still continuing to grow. Our first slide, please. From the Industrial Outlook of the U.S. Department of Commerce in 1971, we found this chart where the projected usage of relays up in 1980 is, it looks like, about a 50% increase over what we're using now. And as automation replaces manual control, relays are being used in greater numbers as well as solid state, because this rate of growth curve is just about the same as predicted for solid state switching systems in this publication. We'd like to point out some of the possible advantages that the electromagnetic relay may have over solid state. Why would we consider electromagnetic relays? Well, we can expect that the relay will handle a high voltage system or a low voltage system. If a particular switching application is known and the exact solid state device is put into that application, you're in good shape. But in a relay, it handles a high or low voltage system equally well. Solid state, you must be more specific. How about transient immunity? We have to consider transients for two reasons. The transient that comes along on the input or sometimes on the output that causes false operation, is one of the biggest headaches in the use of solid-state devices on switching. Whereas the relay, the coil is practically immune to a transient unless it's a very long-lived transient to cause a false actuation of the coil. Transients on the output circuits are practically ignored by a hard contact system, or they may cause false firing even out there on the output on the solid state device. If we're looking for one input to handle several outputs, either in the normally open or normally closed or in a double throw mode, a electromagnetic relay is a natural for this kind of action, whereas it can be done with solid state with considerable difficulty in the circuitry. The rating that the contact has on a relay has essentially a high and a low limit, but it handles the high limit as well as the low limit without regard for one or the other. If you tried to do the same thing with a specific solid state device, you have to pay attention to a minimum maintain current and the excess current, of course, with excess heating could not be tolerated. The isolation that a relay provides between input and output is recognized as, infinity or up to breakdown of the insulation. We're talking now up into kilovolts, or if you want to talk in ohms, many thousands of megohms isolation between input and output. And if you have multiple outputs, you get a natural circuit isolation between these outputs too. This condition in solid state systems, the need for isolation has brought out some new devices in the optically coupled systems that are picking up some of this isolation problem. One of the most important considerations in the use of a relay, and we find that relays are being used to back up solid-state systems when it comes to removing the system from the line in complete electrical turn-off condition. This is a natural with hard contact relays where the circuit is interrupted fully compared with a solid-state system which might be left in a condition where it would be dangerous because of possible shock. In the fully closed condition, the relay exhibits a circuit continuity that has a contact voltage drop in the millivolt range, where most of the solid state systems recognized to be considerably higher than that. In rating a solid-state device, we must pay close attention to the temperature at which this device is operated, and also the self-heating of the device, the temperature that it causes, the temperature, natural temperature rise within the rating of the device. And of course, there's great care taken in rating solid-state devices so that there's always a temperature characteristic that goes with it, and possibly a specific heat sinking or a specified airflow necessary. But with the relay, at least in the area of the contact rating, within reasonable temperature limits, the contact system doesn't seem to care. We must recognize that the coil, which is wound with magnetic copper, is susceptible to a resistance change with temperature, and that has to be recognized in specifying the pickup point when you're measuring it at room temperature. So the temperature difference as far as the contact system is concerned in a relay is practically unaffected by temperature. For versatility, a given relay could be applied for many, many different applications. Within its rating, whereas a solid-state device may have to be selected very carefully. One specific solid-state device may be good for one job and not another, whereas the relay is far more versatile. Also, in selecting relays, if you have a given input condition, so many watts or milliwatts available at a certain voltage to feed this relay, you have a wide variety of relays to choose from, whereas I'm not so sure you can have the same choice in the solid-state device. The relay industry has changed some in trying to keep up with modern assembly techniques. We realize that these modern cabinets with printed circuit cards and so forth are desirable. And when relays are specified in a system, it's possible to assemble them using the same techniques. Thus, you see the recent addition, such as the dual inline relays, consisting of reeds in the 14-pin package that look just like an integrated circuit part. It's compatible, generally compatible with the rest of the system. This slide shows some of the variety of relays available, and all of these are still being bought by a variety of people. They have their own choice as to what they want to do with them, how they want to make their connections to them, and so forth. We have here some terminals that the old-fashioned screw-type terminals. We see some plug-in units, and then the smaller units that are difficult to see there are made for printed circuit soldering to a printed circuit board. Now, in the use of relays, at one time, control systems consisted practically 100% relays. Some of these systems are being broken down into combination systems where they're partly solid state, partly relays. You might call this system a hybrid system. And there are relays used directly in conjunction with a solid state device that are considered hybrid relays, where you might have an electromagnetic input with a solid state output, such as a reed switch triggering a triact, or you might have solid state input with electromagnetic input or output in the case of some time delays or some voltage sensing devices, where the output can be a conventional relay. Also, in the realm of life expectancy, Some of the more recent read relay packages can easily be expected to go 100 million operations within a given load rating. So that these may be considered where solid state will certainly do the job, but perhaps relays of this type would do it just as well. We'd like to go through a checklist of some of the things to consider when you're faced with making a decision as to whether to go with relays or solid state. What are the life requirements? A relay has, most relays have moving parts subject to wear. When you have a heavy armature pounding in against a core that's attracting it in, and it comes to a sudden stop, there's bound to be some mechanical pounding, and there is a finite life expectancy. However, assuming that the contact load is well within the life capabilities, the relay would eventually wear out mechanically if nothing else happened. Usually the thing that happens is that the hard contacts are the first thing to go. So if there is a need for extremely long life, this might be a case against the choice of an electromagnetic relay. Are the currents known? Do we know what we're going to drive with this system? If we're trying to make up a system that's good for all kinds of outputs, it might be wise to stay with an electromagnetic device. Because in solid-state devices, we may be in trouble if we call upon to switch inductive loads, especially if we're not prepared ahead of time as part of the circuitry to handle that kind of loading. So if you're not sure exactly what you're going to switch, it may be wise to stay with a hard contact device. Must this device still be alive after a short out on the line? If you have an accidental short circuit, which caused the fuse to blow, what will be left of our contact-making device after this short is corrected? In most cases, a relay will be there on the job, ready to go again, and chances are the solid-state device will have fused out. What do we know about our inputs? If the relay coil sees a transient on the input line or hash, whatever, it practically ignores it. It would take a long-lived transient to actuate the electromagnetic device. The solid-state device may respond to these transients and give you a false turn-on, and steps would have to be taken to clean up that input or suffer this false firing. Must the load be completely off? This is, as we mentioned before, a true on-off condition. If you must remove the system from the line, you must consider a hard contact device of some kind in there, and a relay would do the job adequately. The condition here that you're faced with when you're sending devices out into the field. Who's going to use it? Is the electrician in the plant where this automatic control system is going to be used, is he capable of servicing it? Are you willing to send the service people out to keep a constant check on any possible fault conditions? Most of the people using relay systems have grown accustomed to their pitfalls, and if they have a problem, they know what to do about it. So it may be that your customers are just not equipped yet to handle a sophisticated switching system. In checking out your list, a given input has to provide how many outputs. This is easily done with a relay, where it might be quite complex with solid state. How about spare parts? Is the solid state system going to be able to be able to stock in quantities that the customer can afford? Usually when they're mounted on printed circuit cards, what he wants to do is to pull that card and put another one in its place. And if the solid state system is arranged on cards, he's going to have to stock a complete card as his spare. Or if it's broken down into relays, and the replacement of one relay for another is a rather simple exchange. Another possible problem is, what about the operation within your shop? If you're assembling a control system that's arranged using the solid state techniques, must the operator on the floor learn how to solder to these cards, or are you going to provide him with a terminal strip? What is the termination? Are you going to have to rearrange your whole technique on your assembly floor? Does your operation justify this kind of a changeover? The relay system using conventional screw terminals may be your best choice here. In the use of automatic control systems, if you have a system design, you're sure to find customers that want something just a little bit different. Is your solid state system flexible enough so that you can go back, make the changes that would be necessary to provide this customer with these extras? It may be that a change of this nature can be more readily made in a relay system. We have here a solid state device that provides two normally open and two normally closed contacts. Actually, they're triax. The input is completely isolated from each of the outputs, and the unit is arranged in a piece of hardware that's suitable for use in a relay system. There's one difference. It must be a three-wire input device. There must be a source voltage present at all times to perform the switching function. But in a system where maybe the entire system could be very well done with relays, except for one or two stations, perhaps in a machine where the normal repetition of one of the stations is such that you have a normal relay wear out in a month or 6 weeks' time. And if that's the case, why condemn the entire system for that one position? We would suggest that here's a case for a relay system to be supplemented with one or two solid state devices that in function appear to be a relay, but they actually provide the long life necessary for that particular station. I believe that's all we have to discuss on that matter.
Thank you, Hugh. Our second speaker will take the case for solid-state switching. His paper is entitled Power Switching Using Solid-State Relays. Mr. Thomas McNulty comes to us from RCA, where he's an engineering leader in the thyristor and rectifier engineering department. Mr. McNulty received his BSEE in 1966 at the Newark College of Engineering, and his experience includes digital design of logic systems, bidirectional counting systems, and traffic control. And Mr. McNulty joined RCA in 1966 as an applications engineer in SCR and TRIAC design. Mr. McNulty.
Thank you, Sid. We have the first slide, please. Now, before I start, I'd like to make about 2 points. Number one is I represent RCA Somerville, New Jersey. I'm in the thyristor rectifier engineering, and we do not make solid-state relays. We do make a TRIAC, which I feel is the power element for any solid-state relay, particularly an AC relay. I have to yield over to the transistor for a DC relay, because as yet we do not know how to make an SCR where we can turn it on and off like a transistor. Second point, we are honoring the 25th anniversary of the TRIAC, or transistor, not the TRIAC. There's been a lot of changes made in the past 25 years. We hardly see a discrete transistor anymore. It's all transistors arrays. Linear and digital ICs are coming on very strong. The TRIAC is roughly 10 years old. In the past 10 years, there's also been corresponding improvement in the technology of TRIACs. We're talking higher volts, higher currents, less immunity to false turn-on, more sound device. I'd like to take it through the fabrication of a TRIAC. The 7 basic steps is what I'm going to refer to. First of all, we start out with an N-type silicon, high resistivity. Approximate width of this wafer is roughly 7 to 8 mils. Our second step, we diffuse deep P layers on both sides of the wafers. This is simultaneous diffusion. Now we formed PNP junction. This is a transistor, and the in-base region right there is the one where we support the high volts, high temperature. It's a wide region, roughly 4 mils of the total 7 or 8 mils. Our third step in the process is we grow silicon dioxide film, define and diffuse the P plus regions. Right here is the silicon dioxide film, there and on the bottom. In effect, what we're doing is opening up windows so we can deposit our P plus. The fourth step, we got to get into an N plus. We again grow silicon dioxide film, define and diffuse the N plus regions. So the P plus that we just diffused in, we protect it by the silicon dioxide. In effect, we're opening up a windows again so we can diffuse in our N plus. That's about the fourth step in our process. The next step, define and etch gate motes and grids. Here's our gate motes. We're separating the gate from the P. We define our grids. The purpose here is we want to deposit glass. Now I'm going to stress glass passivated triacs because if we're not all glassed in 1973, we'll surely be all glassed in 1974. And I think this is one of the technological improvements that is going on in triacs. So we apply and fire hard glass into grids, into motes. In fact, we cover top and bottom of the pellet. Now we see the triac. Vertically, it's five layers. Come up on one side, we'll see a PNPN. And on the other side, reverse PNPN. The purpose here is bidirectional current flow. So we can take a look at a triac as being two halves. One in SCR, they'll carry positive current, and the other SCR to carry the negative current. This is what gives us the bidirectional properties. Next step is we have to separate the pellets from the wafers. First thing we have to do is open up the contact areas, metallize, using a nickel lead tin solder. And we laser scribe. And then break into pellets. In the end region, this is one blocking junction. This is our second blocking junction. Either one of these will block the positive or negative voltages that are applied to it. Note that it is entirely protected by glass passivation. This pellet here is electrically good. Can be used without any form of case, protection, what have you. Our purpose in RCA Somerville is to package this device and provide three leads so that you yourself can come in and make your electrical contacts. Okay, I don't know how long it's taken me to go over this fabrication of a triac. I'd say roughly possibly 7 minutes or so. In the actual manufacturing, we're probably talking 7 weeks. I'm sure our management wishes the factory could turn around in a 7 minute time frame like that, but it's impossible. Let's take a look at some wafers. Right here, you can count the number of usable pellets on here. I think there's roughly about 12 to 15. This is our 80M triac. That's roughly about a 2-inch wafer. Move off to the right is our 40M triac. See the increase in the number of pellets on these wafers. Move over here into glass passivation. These are 8-amp triacs and SCRs, and on the bottom one, we move into the lower current triacs, 2.5 amperes. This might answer some of their questions as to why an 80-amp triac, 40-amp triacs are a little more on the expensive side than some of our 8-amp devices. Right here, you can see the pellet yields, number of pellets per wafer is very few. A little mishap in our manufacturing and cracking that wafer reduces our yield considerably. Here's our glass passivated devices. Notice that they're square rather than round. The purpose here, as I mentioned, is that we use laser separation. And we can't take a laser and run it around a circle. So we form streets up and down, pass through a laser, making a cut just like this, and flip it 90 degrees, and then come down. The laser separates the pellets for us. You can actually take this wafer after laser separation and just break these pellets apart with your fingers. In the rounder type, these are non-passivated. Here we use chemical etch separation to remove the pellets. So it gives you an overall look, I think, and a little base that you can take as to the size of the pellet, reference the current handling capability. The middle one, 80 amp triac, roughly about 300 mils diameter. Here we're about 200 mils diameter, and here we're working about 142 mils to the grid. Now about packages. TO5s, TO66s, popular versi-watt package for the low end, 8 amperes on down. As we move up in current, we give them to the heftier packages, press fit or on stud, and our 80 amp device, 3/4 inch press fits. Passivation, where are we? 120 mils, 6 amper, 142, give us an 80 amp device. And under development, 204 mil square, 40 amp device. I'd like to point out that in our process, to make devices less prone to false turn-on. We desensitize the emitters. Now, there's two emitters here, top and bottom. If you take a look at the gate lead right in the middle, you can come down that gate lead, go hit the P under the N plus, and then back out again. So in effect, I come right through a P region, which is an emitter short for that N plus. Same thing as on the bottom. Note here that the N plus is not brought out to the edges. And this is in full metallic contact, therefore the P plus region in effect shorts out or shunts the N plus region. That's the area that's susceptible to false turn on. So we take steps on the pellet itself to desensitize it, because we recognize that an external resistor on a gate hanging a couple inches away from the device cannot be as effective as diffusing a resistor under the N plus emitters. So you can see that the improvement in TRIAC design over the past years, there's a great amount of effort into making TRIACs less prone to false turn-on, better current capability, better voltage capability. All right, let's take a look at some of the advantages of SSRs. I'm not really going to talk about any disadvantages. In life, EMR physically makes and breaks load currents, and the relay contacts deteriorate with life. SCRs, SSRs have no moving parts and may be designed to make and break at zero current. Regardless of the design, the TRIAC always breaks at zero current. Let me talk a little bit about this. We think of a TRIAC or SCR as being a voltage device. A voltage is a rating. That's what it can support in the off state. Basically, the TRIAC, SCR, is a current device. We inject current into it to turn it on, and we take current away from it to shut it off. Therefore, the TRIAC will always break, go to an off state at zero current, regardless of the source polarity applied to it. It's a zero current device on shut off. RFI, inherent with EMRs. SSRs are design dependent. If you don't take steps to protect a device or the circuit design on a turn-on, you can provide RFI interference. I'd like to introduce a new term called AFI, audio frequency interference. I'm saying terrible with EMRs, particularly when many relays are clacking about. They're not noticeable with SSRs. I don't know if some of you have heating system, hot air heating systems, but I do at my home. And sometimes around 2 or 3 in the morning, my relay cuts in, and I keep running downstairs to see who's trying to break in. It's that noticeable. Environment. High humidity, corrosion, and naturally explosive atmospheres will dictate a sealed relay. SSRs can be easily be potted. Shock, no question. The relay has a moving part, so it can't survive much of shock. Input logics, it's design dependent on SCRs. I think it's equivalent to or probably more versatile than the EMRs. Okay, now, what's your base in manufacturing a TRIAC? What kind of voltage ranges are you after? On the vertical scale, we're talking about volts, 2,000, 2,000 volts. And on the bottom, impurity concentrations and resistivity. This is your basic design parameters. Where do you want to work in? Do you want to work in the low volts, or do you want to work in the high volts? Our decision at Somerville has been to go into the high volts, 600 to 1,000 volts. And we want to stay away from the avalanche limited. We would rather provide devices which punch through capability. And this is important that in an overvoltage condition, if we get into an avalanche region, the power dissipated on the surface edge can degrade a TRIAC. However, if we can get into the punch through, the device will switch on and absorb the power without any degrading effects. So this sets our base as to where we want to go. We're up in the 2,000, 4,000, 6,000 volt category. Next point is temperature. Yes, we're temperature limited. On the far end of the scale, 300 degrees C, here I'll call it materials limitation. Resins, package, plastics, clips, soldering capability, metallization. As we move down around 250 degrees C, we're starting to talk about our thermal runaway limits. Thyristor, SCR, being regenerative, any additional carriers created by the higher temperature may be beta multiplied, causing the triac to turn on. Around 175 degrees C, we see no voltage at all. As we move down into 150, we begin to see some voltage capability. In the region of 100 to 125, we do see above 2, up around 6, possibly 800 volts. We're basically talking in the 110, 125 degrees C area. Maybe in 73 or 74, we might see something even higher. So we have defined our voltage and temperature limits. These are parameters on a data sheet, which in your circuit design, you have to use as the limiting parameters. Let's see what makes a triac switch. I said before that a triac is in effect two SCRs. So for the purpose of a model, let's take a look at an SCR because I think it's less simplified. Symbol, anode gate cathode, four layers, PN, PN. Now note that the N and P regions are shared in this model by the base and collectors. Therefore, I can take two transistors, two discrete transistors, connect them in this regenerative mode, and I will in effect have myself an SCR. The upper device, PNP, beta action, current subdivision, base current flowing into the collector current of the NPN, and the collector current of the PNP supplies the base current of the NPN. So it is connected up in a regenerative mode. Let's take this circuit now, or this model, and bring it back to some voltage through a limiting resistor, and let's see how it reacts to a gate current flow. Notice one thing, I put in a shunting resistor. The purpose is the triac SCR, being a high voltage, high temperature device, having any current migration across into the base, will be beta multiplied. And if the beta multiplication continues, the device cannot support a voltage. So I shunt out the base or the additional high temperature leakage carriers. In effect, in the actual manufacture of the triac, I showed you that P region short across the N plus region. I consider the model to be in the off state. I apply a signal IGT. I forward bias the NPN, causing beta action, which says is that I'm going to have a collector current. The collector current is out of the PNP, and by beta action, subdivision of currents, I get an emitter current flow, collector flow into the base. Now, if the main current flow coming down here is enough to maintain this device into regeneration, I can remove my gate signal. Now note also is that I cannot turn this device off because of the series resistance coming into the base. So the only way I can shut this device off is to reduce that current down to zero. Now I'd like to make 2 points here. Number one is when I first turned it on, I said I had to have enough principal current flow to keep this device in a conduction. This is latching current, very similar to a relay. All right, now I have the device in a conduction, and by some means, I reduced the voltage here, which says that I got a corresponding decrease in current. If I reach a finite point, this device will not remain into saturation, but will pull out. And as it pulls out, it'll further reduce the current flow. The device will shut off. This is what I'm referring to as holding current. So in effect, from the model, we can see latching and holding current. Latching on turn on, holding current on turn off. Very similar to the relays. Up, back up on. A little slick with the fingers there. Surge current capability. Because they are regenerative, they maintain a low on-state voltage. We can absorb high inrush currents. This is a profile of our 40-amp triac. Single cycle surge capability, 300 amperes peak. All the way down, I can't see that number out there. It looks like 1,000. But it says at 1,000 cycles, we're still... well, roughly at the RMS rating of the device. Now, in the actual application, don't think that you can have a fault current that could follow this curve. What I'm saying is there are points on this curve that you can use this triac with. For example, if I had 100 amp inrush peak, I can run out to just about this point, which says that I can have 100 cycles. Nothing will happen to that triac. It'll absorb it. Oh, wait, something may happen to the triac, and that's up in here. I may lose gate control. The reasons being that additional power will raise the junction temperature in excess of the device rating, which says on the last charts, I've run out of blocking voltage capability. So what? Device just sits there. After the inrush is over, we regain thermal equilibrium and revert to the blocking state if we remove a gate signal. So what I'm saying is, we may or we may not lose control of the triac during the inrush. But remember, you can't take this curve and follow it. This is a profile of device capability. You have to work at discrete points along the curve. So we see that the triac has excellent inrush capability. Okay, here we go. The VDTs and DIDTs, the phantoms, what are they? Just last week, I was talking to a fellow who was designing an AC contactor using SCRs. So I said, well, why do you want to use SCRs? Why don't you use a triac? And he says, oh, he says, I was told that triacs have poor DVDTs. So I said, well, what do you mean by poor DVDTs? He says, well, they can't handle good DVDTs. But I says, in what respect are you talking about? He didn't know. But someone had said DVDTs. I've read in a number of articles, solid-state relays are restricted in use because of DIDTs and DVDTs. It's almost getting to the point, as one fellow told me, that the triac had VD. This is not true. The triac has DVDT, DIDT limitations, definitely doesn't have VD, and I call them the phantoms. What are they? I think we ought to understand them. Let's take DIDT. There's two conditions of DIDT. This is on turn on and turn off. Now, commutating DIDT is nothing more than a rating. If you exceed the rating, you may cause the device to lose control. You will not damage it. Turn on DIDT, we have to be careful about. Now, where can we get, can we lower that slightly? It's the most important on the top of that slide, we don't lose it, because there's a load there. Okay, let's take turn on DIDT, because here's where I said you may cause damage to a triac. Triacs usually have a rating of about 100 amps per microsecond. Now, if we take a look at the triac and assume it's going back to a 120-volt AC source, and if you'll accept that DIDT is equal to E over L, then for a 120 source, 170 volts peak, all I need is about 2 microhenries of inductance, and I'm well below 100 amps per microsecond. And I think in most cases, you'll find out that there is enough series inductance to reduce DIDT on turn-on. But where do we get into problems on DIDT? It might be in the RC snubber network in parallel with the triac. For example, if this capacitor is charged to 170 volts peak, and we turn the triac on, and that resistor is zero, capacitor discharge current will be right around this loop. There's the only resistance limiting that peak current is the impedance of the triac and the impedance of the capacitor. Triac impedance is roughly about 10 milliohms, so therefore we could see a very heavy discharge current around that loop. So what I'm saying is, make sure that you have a series resistance there to limit your DIDT on turn-on. And if you get below 100 ohms, then I would say be careful. You might be in trouble under certain conditions. Okay, now on turn-off. Again, I said DIDT is nothing more than a parameter. It's the rate, the change of current as it goes through zero. And if you exceed this DIDT limitation, you can lose control of the triac. And about the only way you would do that is if you took a 60-cycle triac and operated on a 400 hertz line. You should not have done it. The triac was rated for 60 cycles. You should have went and bought yourself a 400-cycle triac. So DIDT, not degrading to a triac. On turn-off, on turn-on, we have to be careful about it. Okay, the VDTs. Here's where we go. Non-repetitive overvoltage. Transient condition. Fast rising, non-repetitive overvoltage. Repetitive voltage. Again, a transient condition. And commutating the VDT. And this is for an inductive load. It occurs in an inductive load, and it's a rating again. So these are the VDTs that we're talking about. Let's take a look at each one and understand them a little better. Non-repetitive overvoltage. If this occurs across a triac and exceeds the device rating, the device will go into conduction. And whether it's bulk or avalanche breakdown will determine whether the triac will be degraded or not. Furthermore, we take a look out here, and we see our little old friend, the RNC, who has given us the DIDT. So we may have a condition of an overvoltage turn-on followed by a DIDT, which can cause a TRIAC to be degraded. So the thing is, we have to consider the magnitude of the overvoltage which may occur and either provide a TRIAC with a voltage rating greater than or somehow suppress this overvoltage transient. The next one is fast rising voltage. There is a DVDT associated with that edge. With the TRIAC, I have some capacitance C. And with I equals C DVDT, I can cause a TRIAC to be turned on, but that's a gated turn on. I've actually told a TRIAC to turn on because of the I equals C DVDT. But again, one has to be careful about this RC network. If the discharge current coming out of that capacitor exceeds the DIDT capability, we find out that we have a TRIAC degraded because of a transient. It wasn't degraded because of a transient, it turned on because of the transient, but it degraded because of DIDT on turn on. So in these two areas, we have to be careful. But they are ratings on the devices, and if you take them into consideration on your design, you should have minimized your problems. Here's a dandy way in which to generate transients. Consider the TRIAC to be in the off state, and I got a switch SW1, which is closed. Therefore, I got a leakage current. Oh, by the way, first of all, the load is inductive. That's very important. I got a leakage current down through the load, around the TRIAC, R and C. There's some leakage current coming through the TRIAC, and then back around. Now, as I open SW1, and if I open it up at the peak of the line, I'm breaking a current. And again, E is equal to LDIDT. So the rate at which I'm breaking that current gives me an overvoltage. Now, I've seen on 120 volt lines, making and breaking switches like, or opening and closing switches like this, I can generate transients roughly twice, possibly three times. I also know that if I can make the proper RC selection here, I can minimize that transient that occurs by opening and closing that line. So it's a function of load inductance, R and C, will determine the magnitude of those voltages. All right, let's get into commutating the VDT. Now this is for an inductive load, primarily an inductive load. V-line, I-line, load purely inductance, we have a 90 degrees phase shift. Now I told you that the TRIAC is a current device. It turns on with current and it shuts off with current. So we can see over here, the voltage is at a peak, negative direction, current is going to zero in a positive direction. If I had removed the gate signal from the TRIAC, it would continue to conduct until such time when the current goes to zero, it'll shut off. Now impressed across the TRIAC is this slope, and that is the peak of that AC sine wave. Now I don't know if you can notice on the bottom there, but you'll notice a little overshoot in voltage. That overshoot is a reaction of device capacitance and load inductance, and this can go roughly twice V peak also. Now two things can happen, is we can exceed the commutating the VDT capability of the TRIAC, it'll switch back on, we've lost gate control, or the overvoltage can switch the device on. So we got to do two things in our design. Number one is we got to slow up the rate of rise during commutation. Furthermore, we got to minimize the overshoot peak. Now in the past, and I think if you look at many data sheets, it'll say R equal 100 ohms, C equal 0.1, regardless of what current you have or regardless of what TRIAC voltage rating you may have. Well, this has all been a brute force approach to it, and it has worked, but I'm sure that it's caused us some irreparable damage in the past. We at RCA now provide, well, I'm one step ahead of myself. Just briefly, let us take a look at the TRIAC pellet, at the charges inside the TRIAC during this DVDT slope. The device had been in the 1 plus conduction. As the holes and electrons start to move apart, we form a depletion region. Now these holes all go all back into the P region, and a TRIAC is being two SERs, half. We cannot define a line in the middle of here to say, okay, you hole, you can't come over on this side, you belong over here. It does sweep over into this direction. Because a TRIAC was in a conduction, we still have some charge left inside this in-base region, and that DVDT slope, coupled in with the capacitance of the device gives us a displacement current I, which adds up to this charge current, turns the device back into conduction. We haven't heard it at all, but always we've lost gate control, particularly for an inductive load. Okay, what I said before is that in the past we've been saying 100 ohm and a 0.1, and on almost all data sheets this is what you would find. So we at RCA have come up with a set of charts, and these charts select out your RNC relative to a purely inductive load. It restricts Someone missed those last two, huh? It restricts the overvoltage peak to 200 volts for a 120 volt line. This is set. This chart is good for a 120 volt line. You can allow or restrict the DVDT during commutation at 2 volts per microsecond, 5, 8, 10, as a function of current. So for example, let's say that I have a load which is 1 amperes, and I want to hold it to 2 volts per microsecond. So it says that my capacitance value is roughly about 0.04. That's the value of C across the triac. We go up again, 2 volts per microsecond, move on over, I guess roughly that's somewhere about 5 or 6K. So if I'm going to use a device in an inductive load, and the current's going to be 1 amp RMS, I picked up the RNC, its number of values for 1 amp commutating, which will allow 2 volts per microsecond during turn off. Now you can take the worst case, select out your RNCs, and under the worst case of load current and load inductance, you do not lose gate control of the triac. Now we know we have to have them for 220 volt lines, so we made them available for the 120 and 220 volt lines. Again, this chart at 220 restricts the overvoltage peak across the triac to 400 volts, and you can work the VDTs to 5, 8, 10 volts per microsecond. So in the past, any loss of control by a triac because of an inductive load is easily solved with this designer's aid network. You select out the RNCs you need. Let's get into a few applications using triacs. How can we use them? I like to look right here and say this is a simple on-off controller. We have an R in series with a switch into the gate. Load voltage is zero until I close SW1 is open. My artist made a mistake. This should be SW1 closed. Okay, when I close SW1, I provide gate current, device voltage collapse roughly about a volt, and it's hard in the conduction, and we have load voltage on out. It's a very simple triac, solid state relay, you may want to call it. Controlling over here could be done by a reed or even a relay itself, EMR relay that is. Notice there that the turn-on occurred at the peak of the line. That meant is that if there was a resistive load, I'd have an abrupt change in current, which is rich in harmonics and will produce RFI. Phase control. I can chop up the AC sine wave, ride variable power to a load just by working with this potentiometer here. In effect, what we're doing is we got a phase lag at this capacitor relative to the line voltage. I've introduced a trigger type device called a DIAC. When I hit a certain breakover point, there's an abrupt transfer of voltage on this capacitor, which produces a gate current and turns the device on. So by whatever position is in this potentiometer, it determines me how much of 180 degrees I get on the load. Okay, if we look into areas in which we cannot tolerate RFI, or we want to have proportional type controlling, I'll introduce an IC device called a zero voltage switch. It works off the AC line, requires no external power supply. It's a monolithic chip, 14-pin dual inline. Come in with the AC, we talk about a limiter and a zero crossing detector. Here it's a full wave bridge, so whenever the voltage goes below the diode voltage drop, we produce an output pulse. We feed it into a triac gating circuit. We have an on-off sense amplifier that we can control or proportional the load voltage and a number of inhibited lines. This 3059, in conjunction with the triac, will allow zero current turn on, and of course the triac is a zero turns off at zero current. So there's no transients involved, no RFI generated in using this type of circuit. typical circuit heating control using an NTC sensor, RP for adjusting whatever heat we want to the load. Device will provide output pulses at every zero voltage crossing, try to turn on until such time that the heat is at the temperature, set temperature. All right, let's talk about AC-DC isolation. The TRIAC requires a gate signal reference to its MT1 terminal. Now, if I need isolation between AC and DC, I have to go into additional circuitry. Now, there's three basic ways that I know of to provide AC-DC isolation. And this is one of them, using a reed relay. And this you might consider to be a hybrid solid-state relay. We turn the transistor on, energize the reed relay, provide gate current down through this R. But we do maintain an AC to DC isolation. Second approach, if we don't want to violate the principle of no moving parts, we'll have to get into pulse transformers. Here I need some form of a clock. I got a pulse train that I can turn on and turn off whenever I want the TRIAC on or off. Now the problem here is that the spacing between the pulses should be short enough such that you can get the TRIAC turned on as close to zero as possible. Here my clock train is roughly 5 kilohertz, which I guess is somewhere around 200 microseconds. So my pulsing is spaced every 200 microseconds, so the chances of getting in and turning on at zero voltage crossing is pretty good. The third approach is light, LEDs. Right now, to provide myself with a zero current turn on, no RFI, no transients being generated, I use a 3059 in conjunction with an LED. Now this gets to be a little expensive because I got to talk about three components, an LED, an IC, and a TRIAC. So it's more costly than the other two approaches, but it does provide the AC to DC isolation that we're talking about. If I'm correct, I think that's the last slide. We'll see. Yes, it is. Okay, just let me summarize here briefly. I've hoped that I've been able to illuminate some of the areas of TRIAC characteristics and parameters, and basically the advantages along with the TRIACs. TRIAC has already been proven to be a truly power element device. It has high volts, high current capability. Probably the only device where you can get the high voltage ampere capability for less than a dollar. Where are we going? The trend is higher volts, higher current, and coming up with something that is called a light-activated TRIAC. That's what we got looking for us in 1973. So some of the problems of voltage immunity, the VDTs, the IDTs, and isolation, looks like we're going to be able to overcome them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. Now for our panel discussion, Mr. Titus of GE was unable to make it tonight, this afternoon, but Mr. Smith, also of GE in Philadelphia, agreed to sit in for Mr. Titus, and Mr. Smith comes to us with excellent credentials. He received his BSEE from the University of Missouri and his MSEE from Union College Schenectady, and he's general manager of Power Systems Management Department, and they build fault detecting and control relays and equipment for electric power systems. And we are also fortunate in having Mr. Robert E. Lyons, who is with Xerox. Mr. Lyons got his BS in 1969 from Case Institute of Technology, and his MBA in 1973 from the University of Rochester. Mr. Lyons is an engineer with Xerox in the design and development of new copiers. Now, if the panel would please come up to the table, we'll start our question and answer period.
Thank you. Now, I trust that you've all taken notes during the lecture, and you each have at least three or four questions. Who will be number one?
That's correct. Available from RCA under application note. Is this on? Yes. Under application note 4745. Yes. That's right.
Yes.
I have a question. About the market for the electromechanical relays. I'm thinking about growing to 50% to 1980. Is the total electromechanical relay just a particular power relays or industrial relays? What does that represent?
To my knowledge, that represents all electromechanical relays.
Does that include wind relay also?
Yes.
Noise immunity goes along with gate sensitivity. As long as we're talking about low gate current in a 3 mil or less, I'm afraid that we'll be more prone to false turn on some of the higher current devices. You might try some external circuit ideas like a capacitor between gate and cathode to make it less sensitive. But I'm afraid is that what we're doing is talking about that shunt, where we're trying to desensitize that N-plus region to make the device also sensitive to gate turn-on. There's a compromise that we have to make.
So essentially, it was not improved,
it would be more sensitive to false turn-on.
Yes?
On the 300 amp non-repetitive curve.
Yes.
How often can you do that? What is non-repetitive? Can you do it every time you reach thermal equilibrium?
JEDEC defines it as being 100 times. Honestly, I don't know how often you can do it. It almost is. Let me say this: if you stay away from the maximum point on the curve, you could consider it to be a repetitive type of a rating for motors and lamps, where it is a repetitive inrush associated with every time you turn on. You can work it from that curve, but drop down below it and give yourself some safety and consider it to be then at that point repetitive. But to go exactly on the curve at that point, again 100 times, because there you're testing the maximum capability.
Yes.
I have a question for Scott. You keep on mentioning DVD-T and using RC network, but isn't DVD-T possibly within the triac construction? You mentioned 2 volts, 5 volts, 10 volts per microsecond. But isn't that if you design the triac properly, the chip with or junction with, you can actually theoretically increase the DVD-T maybe to 1,000 volts or 5 volts or 5,000 volts per microsecond?
I'm not sure which one we're talking about, whether it's commutating or static, but we can take them one at a time. In commutating, I think we're pretty far up on our capability, because circuit-wise, we don't see anything greater than about 50 volts per microsecond during turnoff in commutating, and that's because the load and device capacitance restricts it to that level. But if we want to take a look at the overall distribution, we see many devices in the 5 to 10 volt range, and of course we're after is the overall distribution. Now, as far as static-wise is concerned, and this is in the case of the off-state, its capability is much higher. There we're talking about typically 100s, 200 volts per microsecond at the worst case conditions of voltage and temperature. So that's assuming that the triac had been on at rated case, rated current, and shut off at junction temperature at its maximum. Now, it increases drastically with reducing junction temperature. For example, if you wanted 1,000 volts per microsecond, 25 degrees C, the Triax probably had that capability. But as we go up in temperature, we reduce down. So I would say we're getting up into 200s, 300s, maybe 500s, but that's at the worst case condition, at high junction temperature. That's correct. Well, the snubber network effectively is only good for an inductive load because that's where you have the phase shift and that's where you can have the stress imposed across it. For resistive loading, your current and voltage is in phase. So when she shuts off at zero current, you're shutting off at 0 volts. So for an inductive load is where it counts. That's right. Then in inductive loads, that's where you go into this problem of commutating the VDT. Yes? No, what we're looking at is a light-sensitive triac, where the LED can get down into the junctions and activate the triac, cause it to turn on that in that manner, and bypass all the transistors or additional circuitry involved. So we would be looking at a four-leaded device, two leads DC, you know, a couple of volts, couple of mils type of thing for the LED, and two output terminals, which would be AC. I keep thinking 73 is going to be the year, and it does look like it might. Pricing, $5 in small quantities or hundreds, something like that. I really don't know. No. It's a developmental type device, and developmental type devices will always remain small volume. Until we go into the factory, there we talk of high volume production. But right now, this is developmental, and therefore it's restricted from factory production. No, I don't think. Well, what are you talking about, 73 or 74? Well, 74, there's 10,000, no problem. We will be in the production in 74. Plans to get in production, I guess, late 73. Yes. There's developmental type data sheets available now if you just call your RCA representative. Or if you care to, after the discussion here, feel free to come up to me. I'll help you out at that point. Yes?
One factor in the discussion, that was Veritas EMR. What is the size of the heat sink or the amount of airflow necessary for like 40 amps or 1 square?
You mean operating the 40 amp at rated current 40?
On a continuous basis, you would operate a 40 amp.
Well, I'll take the triac part. We can look at the EMR separately. Right. The triac dissipate roughly a watt per amp. And if you're running at 40 amperes at the rated case, then that means you can't go above 65 degrees C. And running junctions about 110, so I guess you're talking another 40 degrees C rise allowable, 40 watts. Heat sink would have to be a degree C per watt. It'd be a little big. But available, though. 40 amps, pretty big load. Should be a little room around somewhere.
Could you use the box, the case?
If you got a motor, hook it on the end bell. I'm sorry, sir, I didn't hear you. Freewheeling diode? My experience with freewheeling diodes. I'm I can't hear it either. A freewheeling diode with the TRIAC?
No.
TRIAC is bidirectional. The TRIAC is bidirectional.
No.
If you're thinking about a diode in parallel with an SCR for reverse current flow around it, yes. If you gate it on, I wouldn't say that it would remain on after the positive current flow would try to shut off. You'd have to provide some kind of a gate flow to keep it on. If the frequency was extremely high, I think it would be self-conducting at that point. They are looking at TRIACs now in ignition systems. And the purpose there is to take a look and do away with that freewheeling diode so you can allow the positive and negative current to ring out for a longer spark duration. So it is possible you could take effect of it. No, you have to go much higher than that. You'd have to go much higher than that. You'd have to go up around close to a megacycle. Yes, to get it to freewheel around by itself. TRIACs are good for, we talk about it being a 60-cycle, 400-cycle device. Under derating conditions, you can operate this device up around 1,000 cycles or so. So I'd be afraid that you'd have to go extremely high in the frequency band. Well, it's commutating the VDT is a function of current and temperature and frequency. So if you had a 40 amp device for 60 cycle rating and you operated at 400 hertz to get the same DIDT, omega I peak, means you would have to derate the current down. Under derating conditions, we do have a line available at 400 hertz. You've got to be specific on the DVDT you're talking about, too, see?
So my question then is, you really cannot use the same device, same track, for both 60 hertz and 400 hertz?
If you properly derate it. All we're talking about is DIDT there, and the DIDT is omega I peak. I'll give you a rating at 60 hertz, but that's 2 volts per microsecond. Now, I don't know if you'd wind up with 2 volts per microsecond on the 400 hertz. I would suspect you would. But if your circuit is greater than 2 volts per microsecond, the device would not work. We're finding out in our 400 hertz ratings, we've got to talk about the VDTs of upwards of about 5 volts per microsecond. Yes?
Mr. Cullen, have you ever applied your yardstick
I've never applied it in that particular case. It looks like everything would be in favor of the electromechanical on the points that were brought out. There's one other thing that may be the case here. If it sits for a long time unused, and it must operate the first time it closes, then you want to be careful how it's stored. Should probably be an hermetically sealed device or a thoroughly sealed device, or if the environment is questionable, you may want to consider solid state for that.
Just add one more plus for a solid state relay. An area where there is a one thing that I came away with was the contrast of our focal region to evaluation of this critical area. So this push was solid state data to overcome that problem. We don't get that problem.
Question right here. Gentlemen. Do you have any data or insight into the failure that this is a very much so? She wants to go through an open, eventually fail. I think this is the main advantage of realizing this part of the audience today is a fail-safe operation. We're pretty sure realizing my type of there, you know, in particular, we'll drop out the open on a failure.
I think you more or less answered your own question. Basically, the triac will always will fail short immediately. Okay, that would be the first part of it. Now, if that surge inrush was of, say, short duration, high magnitude, then you'll wind up with a shorted device. However, if you can leave it on there long enough, there is a possibility of maybe fusing the leads, the internal leads. So she would go to an open. But I'd say basically the predominant failure mode is a short. But I thought relays, well, it's short. Yeah. I guess the relay usually is open, but they don't weld shut, huh? Sometimes, maybe, huh?
I could add also on the failures of the devices from what I've seen in my applications. To me, a failure is also when the device does not meet its blocking voltage. You've degraded it through DIDT or some other means so that it will not block in one direction or possibly in both directions completely. Usually it blocks less in one direction than another. And in that case, I've had some trouble with transformers, for instance, where when it's breaking over partially in one direction, it may turn on for a half a cycle in one direction, not in the other direction for an AC load, and you set up a DC current. Or it may break over sooner in one direction than it does in the other and set up a DC current in a load such as a transformer, and you lose both the load and the triac usually.
Can you comment on the
I mean, the size of the triac chip?
Application suitability problem.
I'm not sure if I understand you.
I'm talking about utilizing a chip, the basic chip. We're talking about glass testing.
Right.
A better method. I know there's always reluctance in sometimes you can get any chips of that type and then use it in another assembly.
Well, basically, with the glass out on the edges, it is protected against contamination, so she can't support the voltage and temperature. I think the main problem in your area would lie in as to how do you going to metallize this device down to a substrate or surface. The device is metallized top and bottom, but getting in there and making these contact areas, I think most cases have been a problem. But if you can overcome that area there, metallization, and making the contacts, then I don't foresee any problem at all.
Well, I think there I have to agree with the other two speakers in the fact that you have to look at your application in each case as to whether you're going to use a solid state or an electromechanical. In my design for one of the machines they're coming out with, I'm using about half and half. For the loads where I needed long life, I'm using hybrid relays, actually, a read relay in the input, switching a TRIAC. And in one case where I needed quite long life in the area of 150 million operations, I went to a complete solid state. In other cases where I'm switching in the few thousand cycle area or where I have multiple poles, I'm using mostly electromechanical. I don't, maybe GE has something to add.
Now, I would add the same comment that in our applications, primarily of protecting and logic relays, we look carefully at the applications, not only with respect to the life required, but also with respect to the speed and also the consequences of incorrect operation are not operating when it should. Many of the relays and protective equipment that I'm associated with are connected to high-voltage power systems where the immunity or ability to operate correctly in spite of the transient voltage conditions that are created by other devices is extremely important. And to protect the solid-state equipment from being activated by these transient induced voltages is extremely important. It comes more inherently and easier with the electromechanical, but with the proper design, it can be achieved in the solid state. You have to have the motivation to need some of the performance features that the solid state does provide in order to go to the trouble and the expense of providing the isolation. I'm talking about relays that are connected through potential transformers or coupling capacitors to high-voltage systems where very extremely high voltages can be associated, and in fact are really generated by the same fault or abnormal condition on the power system that we're trying to sort out and determine whether it's a condition we want to live through or want to take some corrective action by tripping breakers. So, not a straightforward answer, but a trade-off between what the logic density and the need for the logic sorting out is versus the isolation from the transient voltage condition. So always a trade-off, and you look for the balance.
I'm normally supposed to be up here to answer questions, but I'd like to place one to a couple of the manufacturers up here who are making solid-state relays. And I, as a user, or at least TRIACs, I, as a user, I'm concerned about buying solid-state relays, which I can bring into my factory and will guarantee that they give me the life that I expect them to give me. And so one of my problems has been to come up with a way of testing these relays to guarantee that they're going to give me the life that I'm using them to give me. And so I'd like to ask the two people making a solid-state relay or the TRIAC, how they guarantee that the relays or TRIAC that they're shipping will get the life that the user's expecting. You know, and not in, I mean, by what test methods do they use or can the user use?
Pick up first. Let me take it from the manufacturer, the TRIAC. Number one is all devices are 100% tested in our factory prior to even being shipped into our quality control department. At that point in time, we pull what we call a quality group A sample and check it against the customer specifications or the actual published data sheet limits. In addition to the quality group A, we pull a quality group B sample, which therefore exposes a sample TRIACs to a various amount of testing, in that we stress the device at the rated voltage under the rated junction temperature for X amount of hours. We stress the device in what we call an operating life test, where we run a device with the current voltage and temperature relationship. In addition to it, we perform temperature cycling, thermal fatigue testing, looking for the word, storage temperature. In case of plastic, we'll do humidity pressure cooker testing. In addition to it, not on a factory monthly basis or a lot basis, say every other month or every third month, we pull a quality group C sample where we expose the devices to M&E testing, shock and vibration. And our experience in the shock and vibration line has been very few or any failures. I think more or less because of the limits we set aren't really stressing the devices to its capability. So therefore, we don't have to pull as many samples in that area. But in the group B sample, we do stress the devices in the areas that we think are most important. And that's one, voltage, temperature, combination both of them together. Two, voltage, temperature, and current. Temperature alone, cycling, thermally, thermal fatigue testing, and temperature from minus 65 up to 150. And it's that type of, our history on that has been good, and we feel that the devices going out do meet ratings, capability, and should be acceptable. I also should mention we do surge tested devices also at a single cycle surge capability.
In using Tri-X and solid-state hybrids or solid-state relays, we found that a run-in or burn-in on a 100% basis has narrowed down our ultimate failures. Just like the old tube business,